From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Journalists Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, Mike Oreskes of NPR, NBC's Mark Halperin, Chef John Besh, Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, celebrity photographer Terry Richardson, investment banker Gavin Baker, David Korn of Mother Jones, actors Andy Dick, Kevin Spacey, Danny Masterson, Dustin Hoffman, Ben Affleck, Sylvester Stallone, Jeffrey Tambor, Tom Sizemore, both filmmaking Weinstein brothers Harvey and Bob, Roy Moore, U.S. Senate candidate, Al Franken, U.S. Senator, comedian Louis C.K., Larry Nassar, U.S. Olympic gymnastics team doctor, Oliver Stone, film director, John Conyers, U.S. Congressman. That's only about half of the well-known people accused of sexual assault, harassment, even rape in the last several months. Some are calling it the Weinstein effect. After Harvey Weinstein, a prolific and powerful filmmaker, went down in flames as multiple accusers came forward, some credit the social media movement, hashtag MeToo, with facilitating a national conversation about sexual assault and harassment. Today, we're going to explore how this national conversation is playing out locally. We'll also find out today how young women going off to college, and young men for that fact, can protect themselves and what the biggest challenges are for administrators in institutions of higher education. With us now is Jen Adler. She's the director of Collaboration for Assault Response in Education, or CARE, at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Jen Adler, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Also joining us now is Amber Resitar, director of UNCW's Title IX and Cleary Compliance Office at UNCW. Amber Resitar, welcome to the program.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
And I'm also very glad to have with us Shannon Santana, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminology at UNCW. She studies the effectiveness of self-protective behaviors in violent victimizations and sexual victimization among college women. Welcome, Shannon Santana.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And we are, of course, inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question for any of our experts about sexual assault, we'd like to hear from you. You can reach us during this live Wednesday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Just today, this Wednesday morning, Matt Lauer, one of the longest-serving and most popular TV morning show anchors, is out after an accusation by a colleague. This is the first and only accusation, says NBC, but with what we've seen so far, Jen Adler, are there likely to be more?
Yes, absolutely. Generally, these behaviors are a pattern of behaviors and not isolated incidents.
What is happening culturally right now, Amber Resitar? Is this a witch hunt? Is this the result of hysteria? Is it feminist backlash, or are we seeing a more profound cultural shift?
I think right now we're seeing a really interesting, profound cultural shift. I think that there's been an effort to make this shift before with President Obama's administration and the It's All of Our Responsibility, the various campaigns that they had, but it didn't, and it caught on with the campus community, certainly, but I don't think we had a really big national dialogue that sustained itself like this Me Too movement has seemingly taken hold. And I think it's enabled people to continue to come forward and tell their story and seek resourcing in a way that it's been interesting that we've not seen it catch the way that it has recently.
Another professor at UNCW in the Women's Studies Department told us during the research portion of this show that what's interesting about this moment is that we're really starting to get a grasp on the prevalence of sexual assault. Catherine Montweiler called it a silent epidemic. Shannon Santana, do the sheer volume of stories coming out now surprise you?
No, not really. I think it's very common. I think people are just becoming more comfortable, you know, talking about it now.
And what are the causes of the silence?
Well, a unfortunately, there tends to be a stigma associated with being a victim of a sexual assault. So I think that's definitely, I mean, look at the stories that come up in the news. A lot of times people don't believe the victims, you know, and then people ask, well, why, you know, why wouldn't, you know, why would someone wait 20 years to come forward? Well, because there's so much doubt when they do come forward. So, I mean, that's definitely one of the reasons.
CBS News reported that the hashtag MeToo was tweeted nearly a million times in 48 hours. On Facebook, there were more than 12 million posts, comments, and reactions in less than 24 hours by more than 4.5 million users around the world. Facebook says 45% of users have had friends who posted MeToo. Jen Adler, from where you sit, is MeToo helping facilitate this dialogue? And is there a danger of a witch hunt here?
I think that it's helping people who maybe didn't feel comfortable. Like you were saying before, this is a huge taboo topic in our society. Survivors tend to feel a huge amount of shame and embarrassment after going through these experiences. And most people also will blame themselves for some part of what happened, simply because it's easier to blame ourselves than to admit that we didn't have power and control to keep ourselves safe in that way. So all of those things really silence survivors, and the Me Too hashtag has allowed people to come forward without having to be afraid of that stigma, without having to be afraid that they're going to be isolated with it, that they're going to be blamed for what happened. It has created this solidarity.
Are we throwing too many behaviors into the same basket? Is there a difference between, say, the violent criminal who, Shannon Santana, doesn't know his victim? He just sees her, say, across campus, stalks her, and then attacks her and rapes her. And, say, the fellow student who is attracted to the girl who's sitting in his class. And maybe they go out drinking and he has too much and he pushes himself on her. Maybe behaves in a way that he wouldn't behave in had he not been drinking. Are there differences there? Or even, you know, thinking about a colleague in a professional situation who makes a comment about the way a coworker's butt looks in the dress. Are those all completely different behaviors, or is there a root that kind of, is there a common root there, Jen Adler?
I think there's definitely a common root. We're looking at a spectrum of the same type of behavior. The common aspect to all of it is it's about overpowering and taking away control and choice from a victim. And granted, it looks different when it's a stranger assault, but that's actually a small minority of these cases. Most times it's somebody who's known to the victim. It's 80% nationally, but on college campuses, that actually goes up to 90% of the time victims know their offender. And it's on the same spectrum. And I think that because we do think about sexual assault in terms of strangers, you know, that are stalking their prey type thing, that stranger myth makes it so that people feel more comfortable with acquaintances. They feel safer if they know some aspect of who someone is.
Well, let's talk about the thinking behind it for a second. And Shannon Santana, I do want to get you to weigh in on the power and control issue in just a moment. But first, let's take the example of former President George H.W. Bush. He is in a wheelchair. He's in his 90s. He has been accused of groping women's behinds during photo ops. And he's apologized in the event that he's offended anyone. He said that wasn't his intention. His intention was to make a joke. How can you put that kind of behavior in the same box as, say, someone who rapes a person?
I think that when you have that sort of behavior, it puts women on a lower level. It degenerates the way that we respect women. You know, he may be writing it off as being something that he thought was a joke, but it's along that same spectrum. It's still the same not respecting someone and not allowing them control and a voice over what's happening to their body.
Shannon Santana, what have you learned in your research about this power and control issue that comes into play when we're talking about, say, rape? And I'm asking because I know that you've said effective self-protective behaviors, for instance, if a woman is begging and pleading and crying, she's playing into this dynamic that the rapist wants.
Right. There's been some research that's looked at the different types of resistance that victims use during, it's looked at a variety of different types of behavior, but if focusing specifically on sexual assault and rape, the research suggests that if women do engage in what's classified as non-forceful verbal resistance, which is things like pleading, begging, crying, that's not effective. In other words, you know, the rape is still likely to be completed. And, you know, that goes along with that whole power issue. Because if, you know, we feel like rape is about power and control, and so if a victim is begging, you know, crying, pleading, then that really gives the rapist, you know, what he wants. The types of resistance that have been found to be effective are forceful verbal, like yelling, crying for help, non-forceful physical, like removing the offender's hands, running away. And
I can let you finish that thought when we come back in terms of the behaviors that tend to be more effective in those situations. You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring this cascade of sexual assault allegations that seem to drop in our news feed every single day. And we're exploring what that means in terms of a cultural shift. We have three experts from UNCW with us today. And we're taking your questions. What kinds of conversations are you having in your circles, especially around hashtag MeToo? You can call us during this live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Just this Wednesday morning, NBC announced the firing of popular Today Show host Matt Lauer after an unnamed colleague came forward with detailed sexual allegations of sexual assault. Today, we're looking at the cultural shift that's happening. We're exploring how the Me Too social media movement is affecting the conversation and how we can all be better in terms of helping victims heal and changing the culture that foments this kind of behavior. With us to answer your question, Shannon Santana, a UNCW associate professor in the Sociology and Criminology Department who studies victimization, Amber Resitar, the director of the Title IX and Cleary Compliance Office at UNCW, and Jen Adler, director of UNCW's CARE Office. That's an acronym for Collaboration for Assault Response in Education. And we want to hear from you on this Wednesday. What kinds of conversations are you having with your kids, with your friends, with your coworkers about this issue? You can reach us by phone at 910-343-1138 or via email at coastline@whqr.org. And Shannon Santana, just before we went to break, you were talking about some of the behaviors that victims can engage in when an assault is happening that are more likely to prevent the assault from continuing. So what are effective behaviors?
Right. What the research has found is that forceful physical, non-forceful physical, and forceful verbal resistance strategies are effective. In other words, you know, they're associated with a decreased likelihood of the rape being completed. So as I was saying before, you know, things like yelling for help or, you know, removing the offender's hands, things like that have been found to be effective. But, I mean, part of the problem with this is One, sometimes what's overlooked is whether or not the victim's more likely to be injured if she does engage in those types of behaviors. So, yes, it may prevent the rape from occurring, but, you know, it's possible the victim will be more likely to be injured. And also, I think it kind of puts the burden on the victim, like it's her responsibility to prevent it from occurring, which, you know, just her saying no or giving some indication of non-consent really should be enough. So, you know, I don't want to come across sounding like it's the victim's responsibility to fight back. And right. I think Jen had some stuff to add about that.
Jen Adler, UNCW's care office. Yeah.
I think most of the sexual assaults that we see, the victims actually don't resist and don't fight back, mostly because in the moment they're in shock. Because so frequently these are assaults that are being committed by somebody known to the victim, they tend to like that person, like some aspect of who they are. And so it's really hard for them to imagine that somebody that they like and trust could also do something that feels so, you know, dissonant from the rest of their behavior and the rest of their personality. So people tend not to fight back in the moment. And then, you know, similar to the way that when you're having a heated discussion or argument, like 5 hours later, you come up with the perfect comeback. 5 hours later, they think about what they wish they had done differently. And that's where a lot of that self-blame we were talking about earlier can come from. But in the moment, most people don't tend to resist. They tend to go into a complacency or compliance mode.
Amber Resitar of UNCW's Title IX and Cleary Compliance Office. Why is that? We one of the stories that we heard of one of the allegations against a higher profile man was that he had reached under a table at a meeting and put his hand up a coworker's skirt, and her reaction was to freeze. Why didn't she get up and scream? What are you doing? What stopped her from doing that?
I think there are a few things that play into that. I think shock is certainly one of those things. I think when you're in a meeting, you're not expecting somebody to touch you inappropriately under a table while you're in a room with a variety of other people. I think some of the other things that sometimes with things of that particular nature, we're programmed to try to just keep it moving and not respond and not engage in a negative way with another person. And I think you particularly see that with how females are sort of raised and brought up in terms of you're to be polite, you're not to push back. And so I think that's another factor that can sometimes play a role, is that you are programmed as you grow up to behave that way. And so standing up and screaming doesn't necessarily feel like what you've been taught to do. And so your instinctual response would be to just sort of, okay, how can I continue this meeting and get out of here without having to continue engage with this person? So sometimes you're just looking for this sort of escapist route. And other times it is a safety factor. Sometimes you think that perhaps I would be just safer to not, and maybe taking it out of that particular example, but I would be safer to not say anything or do anything, to just get away from the situation instead. I think that's sometimes an instinctual response.
And that whole idea is another observation that was made by Catherine Mottweiler of UNCW. She said that the current culture doesn't encourage girls and young women to realize their bodily autonomy. Jen Adler, what can we do to change the way we're raising our girls so that they can understand the difference between being polite and being nice and recognizing bodily autonomy, physical boundaries?
I think that in a lot of ways, we socialize women in our society to put other people's needs first above our own needs. And we have to start prioritizing ourselves. We have to start saying it's okay for us to have a voice. It's okay for us to take up space, whether that's, you know, emotionally space or physical space. It's okay for us to exist and to prioritize ourselves. A big step in that is giving children the choice of whether they want to hug even family members when saying hello or goodbye, giving them, you know, the right to say, no, I don't want to be touched by this person, it's the first step in giving them permission over their bodies.
Well, let's talk. We talked a little bit in the first segment about the causes of the silence and the fact that for so long, when victims would come forward, they would be shamed back into silence, or they would have to deal with some kind of very public negative reaction. Angela Lansbury, actress, award-winning actress, who I think is in her 90s now, designer Donna Karan, both observed that women kind of bring this on themselves by the way they dress and by the way they present themselves, by wanting to be attractive. And, you know, perhaps this doesn't happen to women who don't present a certain way. Shannon Santana.
Sorry, I was shaking my head.
Yes,
I mean,
you are.
there's no research supporting that, you know, what women wear or, you know, how attractive they are is related to the likelihood of sexual assault.
What is related to the likelihood of sexual assault?
Being young, being female. I mean, research suggests some of it is tied into lifestyle. So things like drinking frequently or drinking a lot. And again, that's not to blame the victim. But, you know, if the victim is under the influence of drugs or alcohol, you know, it may just be easier for her to be assaulted.
Jen Adler.
Well, and people that are younger, there's more access to them. And so those perpetrators that are out there, to be blunt, have more access to people that are out and about more often. People that have been drinking, people that are under the influence of drugs, are easier targets for those perpetrators, not because the drugs and alcohol cause it, but because it makes people less likely to fight back. It makes them less likely to report to the police what's happened, more likely to blame themselves and stay quiet about it, so less consequences, quite honestly.
Okay, and I'm bringing this up not to engage in victim blaming here, but I know we have listeners who hear some of these arguments like, well, if she wasn't wearing high heels and hadn't had four martinis as she's tottering, you know, she wouldn't have been in that situation in the first place. So there are some moral issues around it. Amber Resitar, how do we or do we get past this whole idea that victims are somehow complicit in their own assaults?
Maybe why this is catching on the way that it is because we're finally getting to a place where we're expanding the conversation beyond blaming the victim, because we've traditionally seen pretty much everywhere media, conversations between just fellow humans about, well, what was she wearing? That's you can go back and look at like Fox footage, CNN footage, any number of news outlets where when they report on a story like this, one of the first things they talk about was that she had six drinks. Well, while that, for example, for us, that might certainly be relevant for us in terms of an incapacitation analysis, but it's not for us in terms of whether or not that should be that individual's quote fault for what happened. So I think we're finally getting to a place where we are engaging in a different dialogue, and so it's going to allow us to move beyond that. And I think that's why more people are coming forward too, because they're not being immediately shamed for the fact, like, we're seeing a lot of positive response with this Me Too and support instead of, well, what did you do?
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about the tsunami of sexual assault allegations against men, how it's handled on local campuses. We're going to talk about what resources are available to victims and why this cultural shift is happening now. With us to answer your questions, Shannon Santana. She's an associate professor of sociology and criminology at UNCW who studies sexual assault and effective self-protective behaviors among college women. Amber Resitar is director of UNCW's Title IX and Cleary Compliance Office at UNCW. And Jen Adler is the director of Collaboration for Assault Response and Education, or CARE, at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can ask your own question during this live Wednesday discussion by calling 910-343-1138 or by emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. Jamie from Wilmington called in earlier and says, I was accused of sexual assault and I did end up taking a plea deal. However, I was innocent, and I pay for that plea deal by not getting work. Is anyone taking into consideration these accusations? If they are innocent, it ruins their reputation. But I agree, something should be done with people who are guilty of these crimes. Amber Resitar is, you know, think back to what happened at Duke University when a woman who was hired to strip at a party then accused an athletic team of rape. And that got pretty far down the legal road before these allegations were determined to be false. So how often does that happen? You know, we talk about believing all these women who are finally having the courage to come forward. But what about men who are wrongly accused?
Statistically, the percentages are pretty low, and they're consistent with false accusations relating to other crimes. So some of the data supports between 2 to 8%, depending upon which data that you're looking at. And so it's certainly not impossible for someone to be falsely accused. It's statistically very unlikely. I think part of that reason is that it's very hard to come forward and say that you were assaulted. It's not a comfortable conversation to have. And so, you know, it's not something that we frequently see. I think both within the legal system and within our UNCW system, we make sure that we have an investigation structure put into place so that way we can fully go through what does come into our laps. I think Jamie's speaking to something that is a reality. I'm a former criminal defense attorney, and it's a reality of just the legal system, period, and not just related to sexual assault, which is sometimes it's easier to take a plea deal than to roll the dice with a jury. That's an indictment sort of the legal system and what we've got set up there. But ultimately, in terms of sexual assault-related crimes specifically, you're looking at 2 to 8%, and it's pretty low in terms of false accusation.
Associate Professor Shannon Santana, I see you shaking your head when we talk about men who are falsely accused. What does your research show about that?
Well, I mean, I would definitely agree with Amber. I mean, that, you know, that 2 to 8% statistic is definitely what I've read as well about false accusations. So it's, you know, it's not that common at all.
So let's say it's not common, but are there circumstances where on campus, say, a girl likes a guy and he doesn't show any interest in her, and maybe she's got some other issues, mental health issues, and so she decides to get some attention by accusing him of assault, and suddenly the focus is on her? And Jen Adler, you're just looking at me with this look like, doesn't happen. But this is, you know, these are stories that people come up with as possible scenarios.
Well, these are stories that people come up with quite frequently, actually, because, I mean, if you think about it, let's make an analogy to flights in our country, right? Like, there are thousands of flights, probably more than that, going in and out of airports every single day successfully. But when there's an accident involving a flight or an airplane, everybody hears about it all over the place. And the same sort of thing happens with these cases. There are people that do lie, but I think that it gets overblown by our society because we would rather believe that a lot of these things are lies than to believe that this is the reality that we live in, that so many people are impacted by these issues on a regular basis. My office is the response around sexual assault, relationship abuse, stalking, and harassment. We have a 24-hour crisis hotline. We do advocacy and crisis counseling for people. It tends to be that the students, I think, that are prone to lie about these sorts of things aren't going to need that sort of advocacy and crisis counseling that we offer in my office. So I tend not to see a lot of the people, I think, that would make up these stories. Not to say that it never, ever happens, but we are less likely to see that and much more likely to see people that need support and are in crisis that are too scared to come forward and to tell anybody. I mean, most of our clients, most of the students that we work with in our office would rather bury it and pretend it never happened and are just trying to figure out, how do I get successfully through final exams? How do I socialize as a college student? How do I blend in and continue my friendships and continue even romantic relationships with this looming over me, and have a lot of the symptomology without ever coming forward and making any public accusation?
In terms of the people who do come forward, what are the numbers on the UNCW campus?
The numbers are different depending on who you ask. Amber Resitar's office does issue the annual security report that has one number, and that's going to be different than the number that the police have, and that's different than the number than our office sees.
And why are the differences there?
So they are, and actually I have two different sets of data just in my office alone because I have Cleary and Title IX. So Cleary is concerned with where these things happen geography-wise. So we'll track numbers for Cleary purposes for things that happen on campus, in the residence halls, in property that is owned by UNCW and is frequent and is not in our contiguous boundary. And then public property that might be running through our property, like the Cross City Trail, for example. That's all that Cleary counts. Now, in terms of Title IX, anything that would impact somebody's educational performance, so student on student, faculty staff on student, no matter where it happened, counts as a separate number. And so they frequently don't match. And the other piece that also makes a difference is Cleary will count non-student activity that happens too, as long as it happens in our geography. That's not Title IX necessarily, unless it impacts our educational community. So there's a lot of juggling of numbers that happens, and we track both because it's important to have that data. But I think it's confusing to the general public when you're trying to figure out, well, where really are we at? So you have four assaults listed for 2016, and that's what was just released in our annual security report. We had four rapes. But for example, we have RAs that often ask, well, I reported a lot more Title IX things to your office than that. And so we have to sit down and parse apart that. And the general public isn't really familiar with these different statutes and how they intersect. And so I think it's hard for people to dissect that and understand why our numbers might be different. And sometimes we get accused of not being transparent. But it's just that we have these competing interests that are really created by these federal statutes.
And Title IX, just for people who haven't followed this, what exactly does Title IX mean for an institution like UNCW?
So Title IX prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender in educational programs. And how people previously really understood it when it started in the 70s, the particular piece was passed in 1972. The statutory language hasn't changed, but they looked at it through the athletics lens. And since then, what we've been seeing in a development of case law from the 80s and 90s, not with the Dear Colleague letters unlike what people really thought, is that sexual harassment is also prohibited by Title IX, which includes sexual assault.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about sexual harassment and assault and how the culture is changing. When we come back from this break, you'll have one more segment to ask your own question of our three experts from UNCW and tell us how conversations in your circles are going. Have an email from Jim to read and a comment from Ruth. The number to call during the live Wednesday edition is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a discussion about #MeToo, the cultural shift between genders, and the kinds of conversations we're all having as this shift takes place around sexual harassment and sexual assault. Answering your questions on this Wednesday, Amber Resitar. She's the director of the Title IX and Cleary Compliance Office at UNCW. Shannon Santana is an associate professor at UNCW in the Sociology and Criminology Department who studies violent victimization and sexual assault. And Jen Adler, director of UNCW's CARE Office, Collaboration for Assault Response and Education. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138, or you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. We have an email from Jim who writes, "It was a shock to hear about Matt Lauer, but honestly not surprised. This type of behavior has been going on whenever and wherever men in power can get away with it. What is different now is that no one is trying to downplay or justify it, as has been done in the past. We're in a place where enough is enough. I would like to hear more in the media, and me too, and what about the I haves?" I think he's talking about #IDidIt. This is going to be the next part in this difficult discussion. And I think that some of the backlash, towards #MeToo is that means there's #IDidIt Shannon Santana, I mean, are the numbers really that high? There are so many women who have come forward with their stories. Are there accompanying numbers of men who have perpetrated these crimes?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, that there are high numbers. Although, of course, it may be, you know, maybe there's five victims, but it's just one perpetrator. Do you see what I'm saying? So, you know.
One perpetrator who's just prolific in his perpetration.
Right.
We had a call from Kathleen in Wilmington. She says, the panel said the majority of cases are young people. I'm 66, and I've been assaulted twice. Jen Adler.
I think that that's what we see in our office, is that while it might be a higher risk time for these young adults that are, you know, at universities, not at universities even, this does cross all ages. It crosses all cultures. You talked earlier about what people were wearing when they were assaulted. And let me just say that there's plenty of assaults that happen when people aren't wearing the short dresses or the sexy clothes. I mean, this happens all the time in every culture, in every age range. You know, and I think that's the beauty of the Me Too hashtag, is that it can acknowledge that it surpasses all of the stereotypes that people have around who and when sexual assault happens to.
We talked a little earlier about the thinking that is the root of all of this, not just violent rape, but groping behavior, sexual inappropriateness on campus or in the workplace. Can we unpack this thinking just a little bit more in terms of how we as a society think about women and look at women and therefore teach men to treat them a certain way? Amber Resitar, what is the thinking that leads to this?
From a young age, we're socializing our boys that it's a bad thing to say that you run like a girl or you throw like a girl. And so you're already putting females at a lower level. They're automatically sort of secondary at that point. And that socialization really continues throughout their lives. Nothing really challenges that. It continues to support that. We've been seeing some campaigning that's gone on in the last few years. I think it was Dove that did the Run Like a Girl campaign, which was really fantastic. But that's been a recent development. And realistically, is that targeting that population of those young boys that are being socialized that way? It's not. And I think we have a lot of work to do that way, because it is ingrained in how they are brought up and how they interface with their peers. And that's the other problem, is that their peers are sort of piling onto this piece. And so it's sort of like a self-perpetuating monster. And so it's difficult to challenge that conception with these young boys. And it just continues as they grow into adults and then function in society.
I've heard so much confusion from men in the community around what's happening. What's a guy to do if he's attracted to a fellow student on campus and he wants to ask her out, or a coworker who is attracted to a colleague and wants to let the colleague know that he's attracted to her and he'd like to take their relationship beyond the office? Is that part of the problem here, that men haven't really known how to do this the right way? Or is that just never an okay scenario? Is it never okay to go after a work colleague, Jen Adler?
I think that it is difficult to let somebody know that you're interested in them, that you're attracted to them. As a society, we never prepare people for, like, how do you let someone know that? You know, we don't offer that education to boys, to women even, right? Like, this is not something we talk about a lot. But there's a difference between that and not accepting or not getting somebody's consent before proceeding with these behaviors, right? There's a difference between, I'm not sure how to express myself in the best way, which I do think is an important thing for us to talk about. Our office actually does a lot of education around that type of discussion and those types of issues. But there's a difference between that and then taking it that next step and deciding, I feel like I deserve this anyway. I feel like I should take this, or I have a right to take this from someone, even if they're not consenting and participating in this.
Heather Wilhelm is a National Review online columnist, and an opinion piece was published in the Chicago Tribune. And Heather Wilhelm's is mocking guidelines put forth by another publication. And she says, we should not focus on encouraging, she's talking about what this other publication said, we should not focus on encouraging girls to speak up and say no, but rather teach boys that girls don't really know how to say no. No, she writes, I am not making this up. Is that part of this? Should we be teaching? Because there are guidelines that talk about not getting a no doesn't mean you get a yes. So this can get really confusing. I mean, is that message kind of implicit? Implicit in that message is girls aren't really very good at saying no, so you kind of have to help them there. I mean, what, Jen Adler, can you unpack that a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, I think we've been talking a lot about the socialization of young people. And that girls typically are not taught to be very assertive and that we are not encouraged to be assertive. There's a lot of actually very negative names that girls that are too assertive are called in punishment for that. And so in a lot of ways, our voices are silenced and we're taught that saying no is not an okay thing to do. We were talking earlier about the way that there's sort of this double-edged sword of a girl is either too easy or a prude, or she's a tease if she's somewhere in between that. And so it really is a no-win situation for females when it comes to having a voice with dating or with their sexuality. In an ideal world, yeah, we would all feel empowered to say no. But these are issues that aren't about somebody saying no. It's about somebody not saying yes. So we talk about consent a lot at the university, and we talk about consent being an active participation, an active yes, rather than looking at where the no exists. And that's really what we hope that people will focus on.
We have an email from Ellen who writes, I want to be very clear that I am appalled and disgusted as well as disappointed in the men that have allegations against them. However, I cannot agree in any way that this means there is a cultural shift happening. When our president was accused and still elected, then women who are assaulted by someone who isn't famous, and when a man running for public office is also accused and still is very likely to win, then there is no change in the culture of the everyday person. There are still many people out there, men and women, who think this is all feminist or liberal opinion, not actual facts, and who are not taking it seriously. Until the president of the United States is held accountable, calling this a cultural shift is laughable. I'm still glad this is being talked about because it's important. Amber Resitar.
We talked about this in the car on the way over here. I think I hear absolutely what she's saying, and I don't disagree with it whatsoever. I think what's really, we're in a cultural shift that doesn't mean it's done. I think we're finally seeing a dialogue that's happening and that it's continuing and that hopefully will continue to go on. But it is interesting. So you did see a president get elected after there's video and audio recording of what he said with Billy Bush. But then we were talking about the Bill Cosby case, mm-hmm. and how that pretty much died, even though that was a pretty significant series of accusations relating to him. And so and Roy Moore is certainly a current issue. But, you know, we saw all of these things ping and then completely flatline and get no traction. I think we're finally starting to see the traction. So I don't think we're done, but I think we're finally seeing a place where we're making some progress and we could potentially continue to make progress. People are not going to change their minds about this issue overnight. It's going to take a lot of continued dialogue for them to really understand that it is truly a problem. And so I think we're moving in the right direction finally.
We had a call from Donald in Wilmington. I'm a social worker and have worked with many women with mental health issues. I've been accused many times falsely, so I do not agree 2 to 8% are false, especially with women who have mental health issues. Shannon Santana. Any comment on Donald's
He said he was a social worker?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, maybe, because he works with that population, maybe, you know, it's more likely for him specifically. But, I mean, I think if you look at overall data, the 2 to 8% is probably accurate.
Charles from Supply says, I was accused by a woman I worked with of sexual assault. The women I work with came to her aid when she could not provide evidence. She broke down and admitted she made it up. So we're getting kind of a backlash here of men, Jen Adler, who are saying, yeah, I'm a victim the other way, and people aren't recognizing that.
Right. I do think that when those situations happen, it is extremely harmful to the men that are falsely accused. As I said earlier, I don't think that they're falsely accused quite as frequently as a society we maybe would believe, but that those situations do receive a lot of attention, and they are very hurtful. Absolutely. I mean, these are situations where it's hard to know the facts of what happened if you're not present, and generally there's only two people present. So,
well, let's go back to acceptable behaviors and how we're trying to retrain younger people to think about men and women and what acceptable interactions are. Jen Adler, you talked about understanding what an active yes is, or, you know, what participation from a partner is. There are other kinds of, you know, comments in the workplace. Amber Resitar, first of all, when a man comments on how a woman looks in the workplace, is that denigrating, or is that a compliment that she should take with gratitude and appreciation?
I think it ultimately depends upon the comment. I think it can certainly be something that's complimentary if it's delivered in an appropriate way. I think a lot of times the ones that are delivered in an inappropriate way are the times where, if there's a reaction, then it's, well, you should be flattered that I said that about you. I think there's a good way to do it. I really do think that there is an appropriate way to say, that blouse looks nice on you. Like, I think you can do that in a way that doesn't make someone feel uncomfortable. But I think you have to be careful about how you do it. And you also have to take into account the relationship you have with that other person. But I think it's that you hit on something that's really critical, is that these conversations need to be things that we help train our employees on. We certainly have dialogues. We have harassment mini conferences that we provide for faculty and staff at UNCW where we talk about some of these things. And I think you also hit on something else too, you know, talking to our young people about what consent means and how to have that conversation. Sex ed isn't consistent across the country, and parents don't have the same conversations with all of their kids. And so looking to that as being something that would need to continue to develop is important, because we haven't been able to have open conversations about sexual harassment, healthy sexual behavior, even though it is 2017. And so continuing to see that develop to enable us to teach our young people, but also our people in the workforce, what's appropriate behavior, I think is important.
Personal anecdote here, and this is a rather innocuous one, but I think it's kind of illuminating in terms of this conversation. It was Election Day, so not that long ago. At a polling place, older man came up to me and prefaced his remark with, "Now, I'm not doing anything wrong. My wife is right over there." And then he delivered what seemed like a rather innocuous compliment. But I thought it was interesting. I'm guessing he was a man in his 70s or 80s, very confused, obviously, did not have bad intentions. But the whole, "Now I'm not doing anything wrong," I felt was not his preface to me. Like, that was not his determination. That was my determination. Mm-hmm. And so, Jen Adler, can you kind of speak to the re-education of, you know, we know this guy. He was an elderly gentleman with probably perfectly honorable intentions. Or not. I mean, how would you address something like that, that confusion for men?
Well, I think it's understandable, because harassment is defined by the person receiving the attention. And so it's entirely possible that one person would hear a compliment and think, "Oh, that's really flattering." And a second person might hear the same compliment and feel offended by it. You know, so it's very subjective. It's on a case-by-case basis. What's the relationship between the two people? What's the power dynamic between the two people? I think that's a big part of it.
Let's talk for a minute about resources available to folks who feel they have been sexually assaulted or harassed, or just don't really know where to go. Jen Adler.
So people that are affiliated with the university, there's my office that's available to them. We are a confidential resource where we can assist students, staff, and faculty. But outside in the community, in the greater Wilmington community, there's Coastal Horizons Rape Crisis Center and Open Gate Domestic Violence Shelter and Services. They are wonderful resources. As a community, we are lucky to have them.
And I will put that information on our website, along with this Coastline post where people can find all of that. Amber Resitar, Shannon Santana, Jen Adler, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell, associate producer Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 and 98.9 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.